It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the national conversation surrounding sexual assault and harassment keeps expanding with more and more high-profile incidents being reported. But sexual misconduct happens in less high-profile workplaces, too, and may not get as much public attention. We'll learn more with an investigative reporter in just a bit. First, the Federal Communications Commission voted yesterday on a 3-2 vote to end the Obama-era policy known as net neutrality. Opponents of the move say it would give internet service providers the power to choose which content is available to their customers and to have slower and faster rates. But FCC Chairman Ajit Pai says it's a restoration of internet freedom. He put out a video that outlines many things that internet users would still be able to do, including posting selfies, pictures of food and puppies, getting great deals with online shopping, and more.
You can still binge watch your favorite shows. You can still stay part of your favorite fan community. You can still drive memes right into the ground.
Brian Fung has been watching the net neutrality fight closely. He covers technology at the Washington Post, focusing on telecommunications, internet access, and the shifting media economy. Brian, welcome to Central Time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Assuming this decision from the FCC stands, there might be some legal challenges, we'll get into that, but assuming this policy takes effect, what changes on a practical level?
Well, a lot of folks think that, you know, nothing is going to change immediately, but other folks say that in the long term, you could see a possibility where internet providers speed up certain websites or slow others down. And, you know, under the old rules, just to give you an example, Verizon couldn't favor AOL or Yahoo, which it owns, by discriminating against, say, Google or Netflix. But under these new rules, that would be perfectly legal so long as Verizon disclosed the fact.
Or if I'm Amazon, I could say, hey, Verizon, I'm going to give you a lot of money. Give me a high-speed thing. If I'm Rob's bookstore, I probably can't afford to pay for something like that.
That's right. And it's important to point out here that a lot of the worst-case scenarios that activists are kind of positing here probably aren't all that likely to happen. I think what's more likely we'll see is that, you know, internet providers will engage in, you know, more difficult-to-detect types of behavior that are harder for regulators and consumers to catch and then complain against.
I want to talk about the history of net neutrality just a bit. People have been saying, especially supporters of getting rid of it, that this only goes back to a 2015 Obama-era FCC decision. Is that right, or does net neutrality have a longer history than that?
So net neutrality, just to be clear, is a principle about how the internet should work. It's essentially an idea about fairness on the internet. And what got passed in 2015 by the FCC was a set of rules that tried to enshrine that principle into regulation. Now, so there are essentially different ways you could go about trying to protect net neutrality, and it's the 2015 rules, the FCC's implementation of it, that really got struck down with the FCC's vote this week.
What's been the argument of people who want to get rid of net neutrality? What are they hoping will come of this?
Well, there are a number of arguments that industry groups put forward here. One is that internet providers say they will be more willing to spend money in upgrading and investing in their networks to make them better and more reliable without these rules. You know, other folks say that the FCC didn't have the legal authority to publish the rules in the first place, so we're simply returning to just the status quo that we had before. And then, you know, there are other folks who say this is a First Amendment issue, that essentially, the rules prevented internet providers from speaking kind of as a private actor, and that this was an effort by the government to suppress the speech of a person. So this is all going to be probably litigated in the next few weeks and months as supporters of the rules try and mount a defense of the regulations and try and get the FCC's decision overturned.
And supporters here point out that the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, would still have regulatory power here. What role would they play under these new rules?
So the FTC is the nation's top consumer protection watchdog, and they essentially are empowered to go after companies that act in allegedly unfair or deceptive ways. Now, what's interesting about this is that compared to the FCC, the Federal Trade Commission doesn't have rulemaking authority, so it can't create rules and apply them on Internet providers. It can only go after companies after harm has been done and proven. So a lot of consumer advocates worry that this could lead to a situation where startups wither and die after years' worth of litigation if the FTC takes up a case at all.
We're talking to Brian Fung from The Washington Post, looking at net neutrality and new rules voted on by the FCC this week. And now there's been a lot of criticism. You've alluded to this, Brian. There's a lot of opposition to this change. Who's opposed to it? What kind of arguments are they making?
Well, a lot of tech companies are opposed to the FCC's decision. A lot of consumer advocacy groups are, and a lot of congressional Democrats are opposed to this. And some of them are saying, this is now time for litigation and possibly even legislation to try and supersede what the FCC has done.
And what's public opinion like on this?
Well, a University of Maryland survey out this week showed that 83% of Americans are opposed to the FCC plan, and that was after the survey takers were provided with arguments, the strongest arguments for and against the proposal. In addition to that, 3 out of 4 Republicans said that they were also opposed to the plan, which is striking given that this plan is being put forward by a Republican FCC.
Now, there's a sort of core, almost philosophical argument here about what the Internet is. Is it a transmission device? Is it a telecommunications device subject to that kind of regulation? Or is it an information business and therefore not like a phone company that can be regulated in that way? Is that kind of at the heart of a lot of this?
That is. The question here is whether or not the government should be able to label Internet providers as essentially telecom companies, a decision that would give the FCC broader powers to regulate the industry and to protect consumers. But industry opponents obviously are against that, saying that the Internet and broadband companies should be treated more like information service providers, a designation that comes with fewer obligations under the FCC's regulatory scheme.
You've mentioned legal challenges being likely. I mean, we're hearing state attorneys general line up on this, some companies. When is this all going to hit the courts?
That's a great question. I think we could see lawsuits being filed, essentially in the next few weeks. It'll probably take some time for these to reach, oral arguments. In the meantime, you might see efforts by lawmakers to draft legislation that would put a stop to the FCC vote or put a stop to the FCC's decision. But at the same time, with Republicans in control of Congress, it's not clear how much momentum there is for something that could undo what the FCC has done.
There's been some controversy about the comments that the FCC received after they posted these rules and they get comment from the public. Some of the comments apparently were pretty fishy, right?
Yeah, that's the allegations coming from folks like Democratic FCC Commissioner Jessica Rosenworcel and New York's State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, who alleged that there are millions of fake comments or comments that were submitted by bots or fake people, people who had apparently been deceased for a number of years. So the irregularities in the FCC comment process and the policymaking process is likely to become a key issue in any kind of litigation over this.
You mentioned this may not lead to super drastic changes, but somebody clearly wants these changes and is likely to find a way to make money off of them. On a practical level, what would you expect some of the first steps to be from Internet providers to monetize this decision?
Well, I think we can probably expect a number of decisions from internet providers to offer new features or plans that on the surface would look pretty good to consumers. You know, AT&T has historically experimented with a service that, you know, gives you a discount on internet access in exchange for letting AT&T browse and mine your web browsing history or your internet usage history as a way to give AT&T more data that it can use to sell targeted advertising, for example. So that's just one example of the kind of features that, you know, the ISPs say would benefit consumers, but that consumer groups say ultimately in the long run might harm the internet ecosystem.
We'll leave it there, Brian. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks again for having me.
Brian Fung covers technology for The Washington Post. He joined us to talk about the FCC's decision to repeal the Obama-era policy guaranteeing net neutrality. Sexual assault and harassment allegations have been all over the news since the explosive expose of movie mogul Harvey Weinstein was first published. Since then, the Me Too awareness campaign has given a voice to many people who have been targets of harassment. And a lot of people, ranging from lawmakers to prominent men in the media, have lost their jobs because of abusive behavior. But there are people who have not benefited from the growing awareness. Men and women who are migrant laborers or who work in service industries are often more vulnerable to this kind of abuse, but they frequently aren't able to advocate for themselves. Bernice Jung is a reporter for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and author of the forthcoming book, In a Day's Work, The Fight to End Sexual Violence Against America's Most Vulnerable Workers. Bernice, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we've seen a lot of high-profile cases of sexual harassment, sexual assault in the media, politics, entertainment. Are we missing a lot going on under the radar in those less high-profile positions out there?
I would say so. Since about 2012 or so, I've been working with some colleagues at UC Berkeley and also KQED-FM out here in the San Francisco Bay Area to really dive into how this issue plays out among the workers that we don't typically notice, the invisible workers who are doing those low-wage jobs and who are often immigrants. So, for example, we've looked at farm work and also night shift janitorial, hotel housekeeping, restaurant workers, and domestic workers. And this is an issue, sexual harassment, extreme sexual harassment is an issue that these workers face pretty regularly. It's a known workplace hazard for a lot of these workers.
And talk about that a little more. Extreme sexual harassment, and it often just straight up sexual assault, right?
That's right. Unfortunately, because of the isolation of these types of jobs, you know, women working in remote fields on a farm or cleaning a building at night, this kind of sets up a scenario where a lot of workers are particularly vulnerable to very violent sexual harassment, including sexual assault and cases of rape, which we've reported on. So, yes, it is quite extreme. And, you know, this isolation creates a scenario where unscrupulous supervisors or coworkers can really take advantage of the inability for these women to find support and help.
You mentioned the immigration status of the people you've been working with. Can you talk about why that makes them in particular more vulnerable and maybe less able to report?
Absolutely. So a good number of the workers that we've spoken to were not documented, were not authorized to be in the country. And so this created a number of barriers. There are already so many barriers for people to come forward when something like this has happened to them at work. There's the shame, there's fear of not being believed. That is an issue. These are concerns for anyone who's experienced this type of violence at work. But for immigrant workers, the female immigrant workers that we've been talking to, immigration status is also a deep concern. Sometimes there's language barriers. As newcomers, they might not be familiar with the laws of this country and so are not aware that there are laws to protect them. Certainly, they know that what is happening to them is wrong and offensive, but are not always clear on the paths they can take legally in order to prevent this from happening. And then finally, of course, there's just a lot of anxiety and concern around deportation. It's actually used as a threat against a lot of these women to stay silent and to not say anything about what's happening to them. And it's a very potent weapon against these women because you can imagine A number of them might be single mothers. They might have kids who are living here in the United States. And the idea of being separated from their families is just not something that they can really contemplate.
And then you also write that many of these women are in very financially precarious situations, which makes the situation even tougher.
Indeed. I think that that is such a critical point. I think that when we're looking at this kind of amazing Me Too moment, what's happening in Hollywood among political staffers and journalists really bravely and boldly coming forward to say this is not acceptable, the dynamics are very similar. There's exploitation and abuse of power by someone with more power. However, what's happening with a lot of these immigrant workers that we've been covering is this very tenuous economic situation that keeps them very tethered and stuck in their jobs. So these are workers who are often living hand-to-mouth, kind of paycheck to paycheck, with a lot of kind of responsibility, financial responsibility for their families. And, you know, we've spoken to workers who have literally been assaulted at work and have been running the math in their head, trying to think about how am I going to find a new job so that I can get away from this horrible situation. But if, in order to do that, that's going to take some time. And when am I going to get my next paycheck? How is that going to work with the bills that I have to pay and the mouths that I have to feed? And so they really just feel stuck in a job far longer than they would like to be when they're dealing with such a horrific situation.
We're talking to Bernice Jung. She's a reporter for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. We're looking at workplace sexual harassment and workplace sexual assault, but not with perpetrators who end up in the headlines, not the big names, in lower-income environments, lower-paying environments, often immigrant workers in farms and elsewhere. And Bernice, even if someone does make that decision, a victim in this situation, to try to do something, would they know where to go? Do they have legal recourse? Would they know how to find an attorney who could deal with something like this?
I think that is a big barrier oftentimes. Once somebody gets to that point where they want to say no more and they're ready to leave the situation, they want to make a complaint, they want to seek justice, there is a lot of confusion. As I said earlier, sometimes it's not clear for the newcomer that there is legal recourse. But even then, finding attorneys and finding organizations that can support them through the process can be challenging, especially as we observe with farm workers in rural areas. Just the number of attorneys in rural areas just much lower, especially those who can do more kind of pro bono type work. There are, however, organizations, worker organizations. We've seen unions really take up this issue as a way to help workers understand what their rights are and then connect them with attorneys who can help them find a way forward through the legal system.
We've spent a lot of time talking about the barriers that might make these women vulnerable to assault and harassment, the immigration status, the financial status, maybe language barriers. And yet you write, despite all of that, some people, maybe more, are starting to come forward. What kind of stories have you seen?
Well, we've seen a pretty astonishing situation occur here in California, and I'm sure it's happening elsewhere. But what I know from our experience in California is, following some of this reporting that we've been doing, there was an effort to put forth some legislation in the state of California to require more training and some other provisions to really try to put an end to some of this very extreme violence that we're seeing in the janitorial workplace. And through that process, which was backed by the janitorial union here in California, as well as a number of other organizations supporting workers, we observed an amazing kind of rush to speak up and speak out. And there were rallies and marches throughout the state last year, janitors coming out, holding up signs that said, "End rape on the night shift," telling their stories for the first time, testifying in front of the legislators, just really kind of claiming their power in a really tremendous way. The law did actually pass, and we've been able to meet with some of those workers since then. Actually, just last weekend, we went and visited some of the workers again, and it's just amazing to see the shift from fear and just worry and anxiety to this kind of level of empowerment, where they're just saying, this is not acceptable behavior, and I know that now, and I will, going forward, not tolerate extreme sexual harassment on the job.
So you mentioned a couple of things that could maybe lead to legal changes and enforcement changes. Is there an effort here for a culture change? It seems at whatever level of society we're talking about, when men have leverage, power over women, usually in some cases younger men, they use it for sexual harassment and assault. Are you getting the sense that is going to change, where men don't think that way about having that kind of power?
I certainly hope so. I think what I've seen in some of these trainings that I've been attending as part of the reporting, training for specifically for farm workers and janitors, is an attempt to begin to shift that culture that allows for this type of behavior. And there's decades of social science research that shows that when the leadership makes it very clear within an organization or a company that this type of behavior is not acceptable, there is less of it. Of course, it's not going to go away completely. You can't, micromanage every person's behavior, but it will be reduced. And so the training that I've been seeing among farm workers and janitors is this, again, an attempt to say to the men in the room that you have a responsibility to speak up when you see bad behavior from other men or other women, that it's everybody's role within this kind of work community, so to speak, to say that this is not acceptable. And I think that's kind of a very crucial step toward trying to turn that ship of that cultural ship that will allow us to say, again, this is not acceptable behavior at work.
Bernice, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Bernice Jung is a reporter for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and author of the forthcoming book, In a Day's Work, The Fight to End Sexual Violence Against America's Most Vulnerable Workers. It's Food Friday. The holiday season is here, and that means the pressure is on to bring an impressive dish to our next party with family, friends, or coworkers. They're going to judge us. It can be a pain getting the food there and keeping it warm, but our own Lori Skelton has a solution. She's calling it bowl food. Foods you can bring in a bowl, throw them in a bowl, bring over, boom, they're ready to serve. She's got sweet stuff, savory stuff, and we want to know your favorites. What low-maintenance dish is your go-to option for a holiday party? Is there a bowl of something you've had at a party that you still remember? Do you have a way to spice up the classics like Chex Mix or nuts or salads? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post. Find some recipes on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lori Skelton is one of our classical music hosts at WPR, an in-house foodie. Lori, welcome back.
Hi, Rob.
Well, bowl food, I think I'd bring it to a bowl game, the Orange Bowl, maybe.
Yes.
But what led to your concept of bowl food here?
Just the idea of ease. You mentioned the classic, you're going to a party, mm-hmm. you don't want to take something that's complicated. As a host or hostess, you also want to have things in your arsenal that will not take up a great deal of room on the buffet table, don't need a lot of fussing to begin with. I mean, you're going to be in the kitchen slicing the entree or dishing hot things up. You want a couple of fallbacks that are easy to work with, that you don't have to worry about spoiling if they do sit out for a couple of hours. And as I was thinking about possibilities, I just kept seeing big, bright bowls of goodness. So that's my inspiration. What makes a party in a bowl?
And no prep once you get there, because you're the host of a thing, they've got stuff in the oven, maybe they're not gonna have room for you to warm something up in the oven. You don't want to be in the way in the kitchen microwaving or chopping or whatever. It's ready to rock.
Exactly. I know it happens sometimes, but if you've got one or two things that are no fuss, low maintenance, but really high impact on flavor, this is a great way to get through the holiday season.
And we don't have to be too fancy. One of the ideas you gave us, and you've got one of the recipes here online, is popcorn. We can really jazz up our popcorn to make it a cool, interesting treat.
One of the nice things about making your own caramel corn or spiced popcorn is that you can make it a day or two in advance, keep it in an airtight container, and then when you're ready to go to the party, you just dump it in the bowl. The one that really was intriguing was something that I saw on they misspell it. It's pronounced machismo.com, but it's spelled M-A-C-H-E-E-S-M-O. The machismo.com blog, Nick on that blog tosses freshly popped popcorn with butter, chili powder, cinnamon, cayenne, cumin, and salt, great Mexican spices. Then he'll spread that out on a foil or parchment-lined baking sheet, melt some Toll House chips, Nestle's chocolate chips, in the microwave, and then drizzle the chocolate over the spiced popcorn. You put that in the refrigerator for half an hour or so that the chocolate firms up. Then you can just break it up and put it in your airtight container ready for the party.
That's sweet with the chocolate a little bit, but spicy too.
Oh, yeah. It's a classic Mexican combination, chocolate and spices, and then you throw it on popcorn, and it's amazingly good.
And this is the Mexican spiced popcorn. We've got links over at the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Okay, good.
Okay. And so what are some other fun ways to jazz up that popcorn?
If you like making caramel corn, and I know for some people that boiling down hot sugar syrup on the stove takes the low maintenance right out the window, but yeah. If you're comfortable working with candy, making your own caramel corn, you jazz it up with certain Indian spices are a great way to play around with caramel because, again, you've got the sweet and the heat. If you can get a hold of the northern Indian spice mix known as garam masala, which is not as instantly bright front of the tongue hot, it's more of a heat that lingers at the back of your throat, that's a really great one with caramel. And one person on the loveandflower.com blog who makes an Indian spiced caramel corn, she gets the American Cracker Jack an Indian twist by using pistachios instead of peanuts.
Mm.
So there's a great way to play with it. It's one of those, you take a bite, you're surprised, and you think, well, this is weird. And then you find yourself going back to that bowl for the rest of the evening.
And popcorn's great because it really, when it comes down to it, it doesn't taste like much. So it's an empty canvas for you. You could do sweet stuff like this. You could do straight up savory or Parmesan cheese and spices. You could take it wherever you want to go.
The thing, though, with something like dusting it with Parmesan cheese, that doesn't have quite the sticking factor that, say, a caramel corn or drizzling it with chocolate would do. So if you don't mind, that to me right there ups the fussing factor. If you have to keep shaking the bowl to make certain that the cheese is properly distributed. Something like that, that's great when you are sitting in front of the television and nobody is worried about anybody double dipping into the bowl. But
and I am.
If you're trying to be polite at a party, you want something that you can pick up and not worry
about. So the caramel and chocolate hold the spices in place, too.
Absolutely.
It's not just for flavor. Oh,
absolutely.
Clever. We're talking to Lori Skelton about bowl foods. Great, easy to make, easy to transport foods to bring to your next holiday party. Now, mixed nuts are a big favorite. You brought in a couple twists on, not mixed, actually. You had one walnut and one pecan today. Both, I ate one. The other one looked good. Tell us about
cinnamon.
This. It had cinnamon, so I had to steer clear.
I know you can buy spiced nuts and mixed nuts. I know you can buy them, but they are so easy to do. It's one of these things that you put a little bit of effort into it, and everybody is incredibly impressed. The pecans that I brought in are from the Saveur magazine. I've been making them for almost a decade, and you take a lot of butter, put it in a skillet, toast your pecans in the butter for about 5 minutes, and then you will add things like chopped rosemary, Worcestershire, Tabasco, cinnamon, smoked paprika, cayenne, salt, and pepper. You toss that all together in the pan, set that out again on a parchment-covered baking sheet, and just let it cool. Once you've got all your spices measured out and ready to go, it actually takes more time to prep this thing than it does to make it, but you can have these pecans ready in 20 minutes. And then the other thing I did, this is from the Food 52 blog. Mm-hmm. I've never been a fan of overly candied nuts. This particular recipe, you can play around with the amount of sugar that you put in, but it also has the addition of butter sautéed sage. So that's going to cut back on the sugar as well. You've still got the candy crunch from white and brown sugar and maple syrup, but this is a recipe where you can play with the proportions. The recipe we've got online is what is recommended at Food 52. What I brought in today, I actually cut the white sugar back by about half, and it still turned out amazing.
That's the maple glazed walnuts with sage. I like that you cut the sugar back because it was like the sweet was a flavor, but it wasn't like you hear candied, you think it's going to be like candy. It wasn't. Like you get the hint of sweet, but you could taste the sage and the walnuts.
And when you have something that is sweet, you don't want it to be overly sweet if it's going to be a party piece. Unless you're going to a dessert party, you want something that's going to play all through the party. And this candied walnut wasn't so much candy, although I did have somebody who tasted them today tell me, I'd really like to chop these up and put them on my ice cream.
Ooh, yeah, that would have been good.
Of the two nuts, there was a slight favoring of the spice pecans. I think a lot of people really liked just how complex that particular recipe is. But most people just said, bring them both. I will eat them both. I think they both of these nuts belong at any party.
The walnuts I could have gone to town on all day. And you have a nut-free alternative to do similar sorts of things. But hey, what if somebody is allergic?
Exactly. Have you ever tried roasting garbanzo beans or chickpeas?
I did it once, yeah. Oh. I liked them pretty well. I don't think I got the roasting time quite right, though.
Okay. Do you remember how long you roasted them and at how high an oven?
I have no idea.
All right. The nice thing about canned chickpeas or garbanzo beans is that if you roast them at the right temperature, they do take on the characteristics of a nut. The best setup I've found is can of chickpeas that you drain and rinse, put that on your baking sheet with olive oil and salt, 450 degrees for 25 to 30 minutes. If you want to spice them up with garlic salt or curry powder, you toss that in with the olive oil before you roast them. I do, however, have one friend who roasts her chickpeas plain and then dusts them with powdered ranch dressing after they come out of the oven.
I think I did the temperature too low.
Okay.
I think that's where I went wrong. And then I just had to take forever, and they were okay. They weren't great.
You want them crispy. You want them to almost be burned. You know, you want to take them that close to dried out, because again, you're going for nuts. And if you're going to go ahead and roast some of those just to have to nibble, go ahead and roast an extra can, because you can use those roasted chickpeas for other things.
Salads
where you might have nuts, but if you're worried about somebody having an allergy, these are a great substitute.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Bill is on the line in Superior. Bill, hi.
Yeah, hey, I was just going to mention my mom's recipe for ranch butter spindle pretzels.
Ooh, how does that work?
Always fantastic to bring to parties, and they usually don't last very long.
So do you take, like, just packaged pretzels and doctor them up?
You take the packaged pretzels and you use the powdered ranch dressing and some Orville Redenbacher peanut butter or popcorn oil.
Oh, okay.
And you mix all that together in a bag. And you can add a little garlic if you want, or maybe a little pepper if you want to spice it up, but after you're done mixing it up in a bag, then you just lay it on a paper towel, let it dry, and then pour it out.
So you don't even need to bake it?
Nope, not at all.
Boy, talk about easy.
That's easy, yeah. Thank you so much for sharing that, Bill. Butter spindle pretzels with ranch powder. I didn't know there was a ranch powder.
You don't remember the original Hidden Valley came in a packet that you have to... Oh, boy.
That you mix. Okay, I'll look for that now.
Yes, it's still available. Hidden Valley ranch powder. It dusts a lot of things quite well.
We're talking to Lori Skelton right now, Food Friday regular. She's sharing some ideas on making unique, easy-to-prepare foods for our next holiday party, easy-to-transport these snacks. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. When you need to bring something to a holiday party, what is your go-to? What do you put out for snacking at a party or for the big game, for that matter? How do you make an impressive dish while keeping it simple? Do you have a way to dress up Christmas classics like popcorn, nuts, or salads? Do you have a question for Lori? Call 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Find some recipes while you're there. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. We're picking up our conversation with Lori Skelton about holiday bowl foods, easy dishes to throw together and serve, maybe in a bowl, at our seasonal get-together, stuff that's easy to bring on over. Looking for your favorites at 800-642-1234. When you need to bring something to a party, an event, maybe on short notice, a snack of some sort maybe, what do you put together? Are there things that you love to see and munch on when you're there, or things that you're sick of? Have you put a new twist on an old favorite? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Chris joins us now in Watertown. Chris, hi.
Hi. Well, I don't, it's from here, Wisconsin. It's called sorghum. Have you used it?
I have not cooked with sorghum as an adult. I know it was something that my mother had in the kitchen for a while in the 70s when she was worried about we need to find healthier things to eat. I will be honest, we never got the hang of cooking with sorghum. I know it's a very strong flavor. It's one of those you either love it or you hate it. So
okay.
If she's thinking about using sorghum, maybe glazing nuts with that instead of maple syrup or something. If
a little goes a long way. Is that what I'm hearing?
At least for my palate, it does. But if that's a flavor you love, then sure, it'd be a great addition to the party.
Chris, thanks. We'll go next to Paul in Fort Atkinson. Paul, hi.
Hi. Being in Wisconsin, my family eats a lot of deer sausage, and we like to make our own beef jerky. I usually make my own beef jerky. I like to bring it to places. I use cow instead of deer because some people are sensitive about eating that kind of thing. But homemade beef jerky is awesome.
I've got a question. Are you using a dehydrator, or are you actually putting that in the oven on very, very low for like 12 hours?
Oh, I use a dehydrator, and I like to use quality spices. If you use cheap spices, it don't taste as good. So
absolutely.
I like to use LaChoy soy sauce. I soak it in LaChoy soy sauce for about an hour and a half, and then I put lemon pepper and garlic powder on it, and that's all.
Sounds great.
It's very good.
One of the things that I was asked to try and make, and because I don't have a dehydrator and my oven doesn't go low enough, I couldn't. But it is possible to make mushroom jerky.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The basic idea of you're going to soak your mushrooms rather than soaking your meat in something very savory, something wonderfully flavorful. The recommended recipe had apple cider. So you cook your mushrooms down, soak them in cider and spices, and then you need an oven that can go down to about 150, maybe even lower.
Wow.
And you need to be able to leave those mushrooms in the oven on very, very low heat for 10 to 12 hours. I've had mushroom jerky. It's amazingly delicious. I just didn't have the equipment to actually make it for this program.
Paul, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. We'll go next to Jose in Minocqua. Hi.
Hi. Just wanted to share cream cheese, a couple of sticks of that, mix it with smoked oysters, mix them together and use it as a dip, and it's very good and very easy.
And what do you dip in that?
Just pretzels or crackers.
Okay. So cream cheese and smoked oysters together, Lori.
It sounds a little bit thick for a dip. I might throw in maybe a little bit of regular cream or something to make it a little bit lighter, but the flavors sound incredible.
Thanks a lot for sharing that. We're talking to Lori Skelton about great and easy foods to bring to parties. You can join in with your favorites at 800-642-1234. And Lori, you also did some work with salads on this one.
Veggie salads, cabbage, cauliflower, fennel, kohlrabi, if you're still getting that in your CSA boxes. Those are a great way to get started on a salad that travels well. Because for veggie salads like this, you're going to want to make a vinaigrette that's actually more oil than your usual vinaigrette for a green salad. Did you taste the red cabbage salad I brought in for the pledge drive?
I don't know. I think I missed that somehow.
Okay. This is actually a Jacques Pepin recipe. Red cabbage, and it's dressed with cider vinegar, peanut and walnut oils, and Tabasco. And you mix that up with cranberries, again, pistachios, and you can throw that on an hour ahead of time, an hour before you're going to eat it, and it will just wilt the cabbage a little bit. It's still crunchy, but it doesn't taste raw. Toss that with some blue cheese, and you're good to go. And so if you're looking for crunchy vegetables with heavier vinaigrette, a little more oil, but lemon is always good with that, lime for some cases, and, of course, orange. This month's Cook's Illustrated magazine even has an idea of making carrot salads less soggy. Instead of grating the carrots, you blitz them in the food processor till they look like the grains of tabbouleh. Tried this last night, and if you don't get your carrots too finely cut, they do hold a lot of crunch a lot longer.
I want to share this on Facebook. This sounds interesting. Chris suggests a great idea for a party. The host makes a variety of crostini, and everybody brings a bowl of something to put on it. Caviar, lobster salad, chopped veggies, whatever. So the host provides sort of that base of the, it could be crostini, a bread thing. It could probably be other things, a bunch of different kinds of bread for that matter. And everybody else brings the topping.
Yeah, that can be a lot of fun. And of course, that's a great way to find out what everybody else's favorite flavors are. If you're that comfortable with your guests, go for it.
Chris, thanks a lot for that suggestion. I appreciate it. I think we hit most. Oh no, wait. Dessert. Oh yeah, I can't forget about the marshmallows you brought in.
Well, I was inspired to try making something that was very Wisconsin after I saw a recipe for pink champagne marshmallows. Remember the woman who got me making my own Oreos last summer?
Right. Yeah.
She makes pink champagne marshmallows. And I thought, well, if you can do it with pink champagne, I wonder if you can make a marshmallow taste like a brandy old-fashioned. And I got a basic marshmallow recipe. I'd never made my own marshmallows before.
Neither have I, yeah.
And the basic method is pretty straightforward. Again, it's a hot sugar syrup that gets whipped into gelatin. You need a stand mixer for it because it takes about 10 minutes to whip this up. Pour it into a pan, let it sit overnight, cut the marshmallows the next day, dusk them in powdered sugar, and you're good to go. What I didn't realize was I had added enough brandy and boozy cherries and orange liqueur to make it taste like a brandy old-fashioned. But once you have to cut those marshmallows, you need a wet knife. Once those marshmallows are wet, you need to throw them in powdered sugar so they don't get sticky again. Once I tossed them in powdered sugar, the taste of the brandy old-fashioned wasn't as strong. So I thought, well, there goes, this is a failure. Mm-hmm. I'll bring them in, I'll let people taste them, and everybody can say, don't try it again, Lori. The thing is, everybody said, you know, if the flavor was stronger, I really like these. Could you make some more? Maybe do just a straight brandy one with Tom and Jerry spices next time? Or I could, oh boy, this would be so good in my cocoa.
Uh-huh.
And I know it sounds silly, but having a bowl of highly flavored marshmallows, again, something to nibble on. You grab one, you take a bite, you come back to it later. And if I can get the proportions right, I think you're going to need about a quarter cup of liquid. But yeah, I made a brandy old-fashioned marshmallow for us Wisconsinites.
And I liked it. And this would really, this is a little more effort than most of what we talked about, but it's going to impress somebody if you bring it.
Again, if you're comfortable with doing the basics, practice once or twice, and I think you'll be doing this more often.
Lori, thanks a lot. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you.
That's Lori Skelton, a WPR classical music host and regular on Food Friday. You can still share your ideas at the Ideas Network Facebook page and find some recipes. You can also go to WPR.org/Food Friday to find a couple of the recipes that Lori talked about. And again, at the Ideas Network Facebook page, share your favorite holiday go-to treats. Love to hear about them. It is today, the internet tells me, Ugly Sweater Day. That's the annual thing where people wear their weird, over-decorated holiday sweaters. Not a lot of people here at WPR are doing it today. No. I've seen a couple maybes. Judith Sears Poisson is in the studio.
It's always awkward asking if they did it for Ugly Sweater Day, because maybe they didn't.
Ugly Sweater Day is a hard day for me, because like, oh, they're wearing this sweater, but I don't want to say nice, ugly sweater.
Right, exactly.
Because they may love it.
So, Rob, you asked me to come because it was not...
For a reason,
Not that I was wearing an ugly sweater, but I have a very cool holiday skirt, which is a constellation skirt with 250 little LED lights.
Right. You wore it at the WPR holiday party. Pretty mellow holiday party,
pretty
I
mellow.
Would say. And I mean, that was kind of the hit of the party.
It is kind of the hit of the party. So there are three settings, off, on, or twinkling. So it goes kind of like, it moves through. They're actual constellations on the skirt, and then you string it through. And actually I wore it home on the bus after Lit Up, which really was quite popular.
It was a conversation starter, I bet.
And it looked very nice in the mellow lighting of the bus.
But not a big collection of ugly sweaters.
No.
Me neither.
Well, not on purpose. Yeah.
Right. No judgment here. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.